Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, August 1st, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Exxon CEI investigations, subpoenas, free speech, and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back two return guests to Teleforum. We're going to hear substantively most from Andrew Grossman. He's a partner at Baker & Hostetler and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He'll be joining us as an expert, and we're also joined by Margaret A. Peggy Little. She's a partner at Little & Little and director of the Federalist Society's Pro Bono Center, and she's going to facilitate the conversation today by acting as our moderator. We'll begin with some opening remarks, questions, but as always, looking to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of your questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Peggy Little, the floor is yours.
Welcome to the this teleforum on the climate change investigations. We will be examining whether this is fair regulation of markets or executive overreach that chills free speech. Over the past year, climate change activists have been urging the Department of Justice and state attorneys general to investigate ExxonMobil, think tanks, and other corporations and organizations that have expressed skepticism or have otherwise presented contrary views either on the science or the policy of climate change regulatory action. These calls have included members of Congress petitioning the DOJ to investigate whether Exxon and its brain trust have violated civil RICO. It includes an ongoing Martin Act investigation launched last fall by the New York Attorney General, and more recently, subpoenas issued by the U.S. Virgin Islands and civil investigative demands from the Massachusetts Attorney General. At a press conference on March 29, 2016, attended by former Vice President Al Gore, 20 attorneys general called for investigations into ExxonMobil and these related organizations. Interestingly, the next day, a majority of state attorneys general, 29 in all, issued a press release that they would not be joining in these investigations, citing respect for the rule of law and the First Amendment. Those 29 AGs asserted that good science embraces disagreement and noted the chilling effect on research when the government decides what is truth and what is fraud. Now, at that March 29th press conference, former Vice President Gore asserted, and I quote, that our democracy's been hacked. And he said that these state and federal enforcement actions were necessary to remedy Congress's and other legislative inactivity. In this teleform, Andrew Grossman, who has been involved in both defending targets of the subpoenas and in challenging the lawfulness of their issuance, will discuss some of the legal and policy questions implicated by this division between the states and also between the executive branch and Congress. I want to add, in addition to Andrew's position as a partner at Baker Hostetler and an adjunct scholar at Cato, he is also one of the founders of the Free Speech in Science Project. Andrew?
Thank you, Peggy, and thank you, Dean. I should begin these remarks with a disclaimer, as all good remarks begin, by saying that my views that I represent today do not necessarily represent those of my law firm, the Cato Institute, or of any of my firm's clients. I think that Peggy's introduction really hit the nail on the head in terms of the major question underlying these very controversial investigations of both energy companies as well as public policy institutions involved in the climate science and climate change debate. The question is, are these investigations a legitimate exercise of government's law enforcement authority, or are they a First Amendment violation intended to chill disfavored speech? Rather than answer that question in these remarks, I cite what I think is a very appropriate little bit of legal Latinism, res ipsa locatur, the thing speaks for itself. I'm not going to give you my point of view on this. I'm simply going to explain the facts as I understand them and some of the legal theories that have been put forward. And the way that these issues have developed over a course of years, and I think that taken together, the thing does speak for itself. I think it's very easy and very apparent to reach a certain conclusion about what it is that's going on here and how the laws are being used in this instance. So in these remarks, I'll discuss three things briefly. First, I'll give a little bit of additional factual background as to the nature of the investigations that are being undertaken at this time. I'll discuss some of the legal issues that they raise, particularly regarding the First Amendment, as well as some of the legal theories underlying the investigations. And then I think it's worth a brief description and discussion of some of the potential consequences of this new tactic of using criminal investigations to influence and participate in public policy debates. So let's begin by talking about where things stand now. As Peggy described, there are a large number of investigations that are being undertaken, but they all seem to derive from a single genitive event, and that was a prominent workshop and forum held in 2012 in La Jolla, California, sponsored by the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Rockefeller Foundations. The purpose of this conference was to brainstorm ideas for legal attacks on opponents of a particular climate agenda, an agenda that favors clean energy and that favors the shutdown primarily of fossil fuel-based generation. Their goal, and this is according to the report that they published, was to produce, quote, a compelling public narrative about climate change in the United States. And for a compelling public narrative, they needed bad guys. The idea was that they would come up with a legal strategy, a way that working in conjunction with states, with prosecutors, with regulatory agencies, with members of Congress, a big picture view as to how all of these different forces could be mobilized to exert pressure in the debate regarding climate change and effect change regarding climate policy, in other words, a shift towards clean power generation. So in this sense, the report reads a little bit like a movie script, and they had a plot right from the beginning. Big Oil and its allies were hiding the truth about climate change. They were the wrongdoers. And the model for selling this narrative was going to be the tobacco litigation of the 1990s, where the tobacco companies were accused of having withheld information regarding the health dangers of smoking. But notably, and one thing was a constant theme both in the report as well as in a number of the models that grew out of it, was the big multi-billion-dollar settlement for states and the private sector attorneys who represented them and who drove the tobacco settlement deal. Now, for the next couple of years, there really wasn't a lot being heard about this legal strategy to go after the energy industry. From time to time, there'd be murmurings about fossil fuels being, quote, the next tobacco, but that was at the same time that other groups of plaintiffs' attorneys were undertaking failed campaigns targeting things like soft drinks, plastics, and fast food. Very few people were aware of this, but while it seemed like there was not a lot of activity going on, in fact, a number of plaintiffs' attorneys, as well as activists, were engaging in small-scale conferences, regional conferences. They were meeting to lobby government officials. They were making inroads with state prosecutors, and they were talking with members of Congress. All of these activities were effectively under the radar until a picture of them resurfaced last summer with remarks on the Senate floor as well as a publication in the Washington Post by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. In those remarks and in that article, he called on the U.S. Department of Justice to begin undertaking an investigation of energy companies, of scientists, as well as public policy organizations, for their speech regarding climate change, which he claimed potentially misled the public. His view is that it was simply a repeat of the tobacco litigation of the 1990s, and that surely such an investigation would find that the public was being misled, in effect being defrauded. Those statements by Senator Whitehouse were met with a fair amount of disbelief. This was an idea that, up until that time, had reverberated a little bit among the far left, among some of the more radical activist wings of the environmentalist movement, but was something that until that point hadn't really seen a lot of practical legitimacy. In other words, the idea of targeting people who were involved in the climate policy and climate science debates. But very, very quickly, public sentiment on these things began to shift. A group of 20-some climate scientists sent a letter to the Attorney General, demanding that an investigation along the lines suggesting by Sheldon Whitehouse be opened. Subsequently, a similar letter was sent by members of the House, and that formal request was something that the Department of Justice had to respond to, and they did by referring the matter to the FBI. But for me, and I think for a lot of people, things became concrete only a few months ago. There was the March 29th Attorney Generals United for Clean Power press conference that Peggy mentioned, where 20 state attorneys general appeared on a single stage. They were their representatives to announce that they would undertake a coordinated investigation under a variety of legal theories, targeting not only the energy industry, but all of the allies and groups that it had supported over the years who had participated in climate science issues. And we'll discuss that ever so slightly more in a moment. But things really became concrete for me in May of this year when my client, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, received a subpoena from, of all places, the United States Virgin Islands, a place where, so far as I'm aware, the Competitive Enterprise Institute had never done anything. The subpoena it received was what's known as a kitchen sink subpoena. The subpoena sought, across numerous pages of very complex legal descriptions, 10 years' worth of its communications, internal documents, external documents, confidential materials, everything you could possibly imagine regarding climate change. It sought materials regarding CEI's public advocacy. It sought all of its communications with ExxonMobil. It sought information regarding its funding. In short, anything and everything that CEI might have done regarding climate change, which was a lot because CEI is very prominent on that issue among many other issues, the subpoena demanded it and demanded that they provided it in short order. But it turns out that CEI wasn't the only group to receive a subpoena. The main target of the investigation, at least according to the U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General's office, was ExxonMobil. U.S. Virgin Islands claimed that the basis for its investigation was that Exxon engaged or is engaging in conduct misrepresenting its knowledge of the likelihood that its products and activities are contributing to climate change. And this amounted, according to the Attorney General, to a racketeering conspiracy, a violation of the U.S. Virgin Islands analog to the federal RICO statute, that is, the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act, which was enacted to target mafia organizations as well as drug cartels. The subpoena that was sent to Exxon named 90 separate groups, including, in addition to CEI, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Federal Society, and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. As Peggy mentioned, that wasn't the only investigation. New York had launched a Martin Act investigation into Exxon and Peabody Energy. The California Attorney General launched an investigation into whether Exxon lied to the public and its shareholders about the risks to its business from climate change. And as I mentioned, Attorney General Loretta Lynch had forwarded a request for a investigation over to the FBI for them to consider further. And just several weeks ago, a number of Senate Democrats took to the floor of the Senate for what they called a web of denial series of speeches. And for two nights on the floor, they named more than two dozen groups that they say were involved in a criminal conspiracy to deceive the public on climate change. And those two dozen groups included all of the think tanks I mentioned previously, as well as a number of other public policy organizations. Literally, they have an enemies list. Now, let's discuss some of the legal issues that these events and these investigations implicate. The first question, I think, is this something, these investigations, are they really about tracking down a crime, or are they more about silencing policy views? Well, to my mind, the best way to address that question, at least to begin with, is to look at what the people involved have said. According to New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who leads this Attorney General's United for Clean Energy Coalition, he said that the coalition's purpose was to, quote, step into the breach left by gridlock in Washington over climate change by targeting what he called, quote, well-funded, highly aggressive, and morally vacant forces that are trying to block every step by the federal government to take meaningful action. In particular, he said that the attorneys general participating in this investigatory coalition would wield their powers, quote, creatively and aggressively to clear up confusion among the public concerning climate change, sowed by those with an interest in profiting from the confusion and creating misperceptions in the eyes of the American public. He said that the coalition members would take action against these parties under, quote, a variety of theories, including, and again, the quote, consumer protection laws, some securities fraud laws, and a number of other laws and statutes. Now, as I see things, certainly other commentators have pointed this out, this is somewhat backwards from the way that law enforcement investigations typically proceed. Typically, when there's an allegation that a crime has been committed, the prosecutor or the law enforcement officials will investigate that, and they'll attempt to identify the perpetrator. But in this case, they've already got the perpetrator. In fact, they've got a list of them, and now they're trying to identify the crime, any crime, or as Attorney General Schneiderman put it, any crime under a variety of theories. So this is somewhat different from the way that normal criminal investigations proceed, in that we already know who the criminals are. We simply don't know what it is exactly that they've done. The second thing that makes this a little bit strange is Attorney General Schneiderman's comments that the point of these investigations is not necessarily to address crime, but specifically to influence a political debate. He made very clear that the whole point of this was to change the public narrative and to influence public policymaking in Washington, D.C. And the way he would do this, he explained in his remarks, was that they would target particular people for criminal and civil investigation for law enforcement activities, and in so doing, they would presumably affect the debate in some way, presumably by chilling those organizations' speech, by influencing the public, by making people think that their views are malign and that there is only one side to this particular issue. Now, as many people have pointed out, that type of approach, if that is in fact what the Attorney General's United are undertaking, raises several very serious First Amendment issues. The first, of course, is that the government under the First Amendment isn't allowed to take activities for the express purpose of chilling speech. This is something that's known as content-based discrimination, and the government generally commits a First Amendment violation when it targets particular speakers, particular viewpoints, and attempts to silence or chill or otherwise take action to silence that particular viewpoint. Another issue that is raised under the First Amendment is First Amendment retaliation, and that's when government officials target individuals or organizations or companies merely because those government officials don't like the speech that they've engaged in the past. Arguably, Attorney General Schneiderman conceded that this was, in fact, the purpose of their investigation at his press conference remarks, which is really what makes those remarks very unusual for a government official to undertake. A third First Amendment issue that comes up, and one that I think is a little bit more subtle, is the violation of associational rights that's possible when an investigation, as in this instance, is directed at people's public advocacy and issue-based advocacy. People, of course, have a right to join together with one another to advocate for particular political views, to petition to the government, and to try and influence the public that their view of things is the right view of things, and that's the way the public policy should proceed. When government attempts to investigate groups that are engaged in those types of activities and demands their internal communications or subjects them to other forms of harassment, that's the kind of threat that can make it difficult or impossible for people to join together to engage in expressive activities. And the Supreme Court has recognized in a long series of cases, beginning with NAACP versus Alabama, that such investigations raise very serious First Amendment issues for precisely that reason. They too easily become a mode of intimidation that serves to silence speech and to remove particular points of view from the public sphere. Now, against the claims that these investigatory activities may be violating First Amendment rights, the response of Attorney General Schneiderman, as well as a number of the other attorneys general involved in his coalition, has been that fraud is not shielded by the First Amendment. And they typically cite a case called Madigan from the United States Supreme Court that actually says as much. And it is certainly true that states have a long history of exercising their police power to enforce laws that prevent fraud. But the Supreme Court's case law also makes clear that it's not enough for law enforcement officials simply to characterize a particular action that they wish to target as fraud. Instead, it's incumbent upon them to identify why something is fraud, what law is being violated, what are the facts that support the potential violation. And in this instance, thanks to the Competitive Enterprise Institute's challenge of the U.S. Virgin Islands subpoena, there has been an opportunity to put the attorneys general to their proof. In other words, for them to have to come into court and explain what it is that they're doing and what is the basis for their fraud claims. So in the CEI, one of the CEI legal actions that's currently ongoing, CEI asked the U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General to identify the basis of his investigation to ExxonMobil and the Competitive Enterprise Institute. What was it that specifically led them to believe that there was fraud going on targeting consumers and other people? The U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General identified in his briefing two allegedly fraudulent statements by ExxonMobil. And I'll just read them to you because they're a sentence each, and I think they shed a lot of light on this issue. The first one was, and I quote, "Current scientific understanding provides limited guidance on the likelihood, magnitude, and time frame of physical risks such as sea level rise, extreme weather events, temperature extremes, and precipitation. Other than my mangling of a word or two there, that is the, according to the U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General, the basis for a fraud and criminal racketeering investigation into ExxonMobil and groups that engaged in public policy advocacy with ExxonMobil." The second statement is as follows, quote, "International accords and underlying regional and national regulations for greenhouse gas reduction are evolving with uncertain timing and outcome, making it difficult to predict their business impact." Now, you could take my word for it that those two statements identified as justifying a criminal fraud investigation are completely mundane in every possible respect, but you don't have to take my word for it because you could go look up the publications of the United Nations Climate Change Agency, that's the IPCC, or you could look up the publications of the Environmental Protection Agency or of NASA or a laundry list of government agencies, and you can see that these are not only well within the mainstream, they more or less plagiarize statements that have been made in recent years by government officials that are engaged in the task of researching and synthesizing the science regarding climate change as well as the policy consequences of climate change. This, I think, suggests that what's going on here may not be a typical fraud investigation. Now, that is a factual argument as to why it is that in this instance there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence necessarily underlying these investigations. But there's also a legal issue as well. The example that's brought up again and again by proponents of these investigations is that this is just the tobacco litigation redux. The tobacco companies were defrauding consumers about the safety of cigarettes, and that was something that the courts held did at the end of the day constitute mail fraud and wire fraud. But I think it's fair to say that there's something a little bit different in this instance between a company that's attempting to sell products to consumers and is making, as a virtue of that product, is making claims regarding its safety and suitability for its intended use, versus a company as well as other organizations engaging in public policy advocacy regarding how the government should regulate particular products and particular and undertake other public policy decisions. That latter group of activities, public policy advocacy, of course, is something that's protected by the First Amendment under the Petition Clause. And even more specifically than that, it's something that in the tobacco litigation, the courts recognized again and again could not be the basis of any type of mail or wire fraud charge. Instead, while there were findings of liability regarding those types of charge, they were all regarded communications that were unambiguously aimed at consumers so as to avoid this First Amendment bar against attempted criminalization of activity simply to petition government regarding public policy. I think there are other reasons why fraud precedents in general are distinguishable here, not the least of which, as a legal matter, there isn't anything that even looks like fraud because there isn't doesn't meet the legal prerequisites for that. But aside from that, there's a fundamental difference, I think, between participating in a public policy debate and selling somebody particular products that may not be suited to the use to which they're being put. I think it's worth noting that in addition to the legal issues that are at play here, there also is, as I've mentioned before, a financial issue, a financial interest that's also in play. We learned just several weeks ago that the states that are undertaking these investigations aren't working in their own, but there is, in fact, another parallel to the tobacco litigation, and that's the involvement of plaintiffs' attorneys on a contingency fee basis. With an eye towards racking up very large settlements and then claiming a portion of that as a contingent fee. We learned just several weeks ago that the United States Virgin Islands had chosen to represent the law firm Cohen Milstein, and that it had engaged in a retainer agreement with Cohen Milstein, promising the law firm potentially hundreds of millions of dollars for its engagement representing the U.S. Virgin Islands. That was really one of the most interesting portions of this retainer agreement, was that the fee distribution clause, who would get what in the instance of a settlement, goes up to hundreds of millions of dollars, which is a lot of money for a very minor economic area like the U.S. Virgin Islands that doesn't have a lot of major business activity and doesn't have a lot of exposure to different types of potential fraud or basis for fraud claims. It's a lot of money that they would expect to extract from the targets of their investigations. And so seeing that, it certainly does suggest that there is a lot of divvying up going on here, perhaps with an expectation that a number of the states, perhaps the ones involved in the Attorney General's United Coalition, would join together and again attempt to reach some kind of master settlement that involves a lot of states and that distributes a lot of money around, both to the states as well as to their attorneys. I'd like to close by identifying a few of the issues that I think may raise concerns in this area. Obviously, it's never a good thing when the government retaliates against people for their speech, but it's particularly concerning when the government does that concerning speech regarding public policy and regarding the operations of government. Speech is, of course, a check on the operations of government. It's a way that citizens of all stripes can join together and can help to steer public policy, as well as ensure that public policy is something that genuinely reflects the will of the people and the best possible thinking on a variety of different topics. So it always raises very serious concerns when the government attempts to interfere with people's speech, and particularly when the government does that on a viewpoint basis. A less concrete but I think equally important concern is the interference that's inherent with civil society. In this instance, being targeted for an investigation are a number of organizations, mostly nonprofit organizations and think tanks, that participate in public policy development that are separate from the government and that largely don't take any government money. These are civil society organizations. They're a way that Americans can advocate in favor of their view of the good life, and they're responsible for so much of the public policy development and thoughtful discussions that we've had on public policy going back decades, if not longer. Interfering with those groups certainly undermines our ability to undertake intelligent public policy debates and at the end of the day arrive at good public policy. One also should not overlook the risk to science itself. If dissent in science in certain respects is going to be criminalized or at least subject to investigations and all that comes with investigations, that will chill the free flow of ideas in science. And it's worth noting, I think, that at least as I understand it, and I'm an attorney, I'm not a scientist, views regarding climate science have somewhat moderated over the years. There is, of course, a consensus that there is anthropogenic climate change that is caused by humans, but there also appears to be an increasing consensus that some of the more catastrophic views that were put forward 10 years ago or 15 years ago are less likely to happen than people thought at that time. In other words, the views that there are going to be wild swings in global climates and temperatures is something that over the years has seemed to have lost some amount of favor among the scientific community. At least that's my impression. And that's something that's happened through a series, through the iteration of scientific discovery and a long period of scientific debate. if part of that debate is going to be shut down, if part of that debate, if scientists engaging in it are going to know that they may face consequences for taking views that are out of favor with certain political views, or by accepting funding from groups that may be disfavored in terms of their policy positions, that's something that will, at the end of the day, retard the development of science, and that will make us all poorer. As a nation and as citizens of the world, but I think something that really bears mentioning in this instance is that there's no reason to believe that these tactics will stop with just climate science. In the weeks after Senator Whitehouse made his plea for a RICO investigation into the energy industry, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. stepped forward to say that, well, why stop with the energy industry? Vaccine makers are engaged in a RICO conspiracy to hide the risks of vaccines in causing autism among children. And so his view is that there ought to be a criminal investigation into that. It's been widely reported that Wisconsin prosecutors used broad campaign finance laws in recent years to launch an investigation that targeted more or less every conservative and free market group in the state. They used home raids, threats of criminal charges. At the end of the day, it was just an investigation, nothing more than that, but it did manage to shut down public policy debate in that state for about a year. These things, I would submit, are bad for science, but they're also bad for public policy. At the end of the day, free and open debate is how we decide, and it's how we decide between things that represent genuine risks to our way of life and things that don't. If something actually is a risk, we should understand it, we should confirm it, and we should confront it. And that's something that speech and debate allow us to do. But if something isn't, speech has the salutary quality that allows us to avoid wasting our money and wasting our time and distracting ourselves from the things that actually are important. If we allow officials to criminalize speech because they say it's wrong, or to chill speech through endless investigations merely as a way of influencing political debates, well, soon it will be even more difficult for us to have any way to tell what is right and what is wrong. What we'll know is what we're allowed to say and what we can get away with without the fear of being targeted by the government. And to my mind, that isn't a very good way to proceed. So I think with that, I believe Peggy has some remarks and perhaps questions.
Peggy, are you there? I don't know if you've muted your telephone, Peggy. You need to come off mute. We can't hear you. Sounds like we might have lost Peggy. With that possibility in mind, this is Dean Reuter, open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for Andrew Grossman, our expert, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to questions, let me check back in and see if we have Peggy Little on the phone. Peggy, if you're on mute, you need to unmute your telephone. Let me try one number here that might be hers. Peggy, do we have you back on the phone yet? We do not. So we have a number of questions. Andrew, with your permission, we'll go right to the audience with questions, if that's okay.
Oh, gladly.
Thank you very much. Check in with our first caller now.
Dean, this is Peggy. I'm the first questioner.
Very good. Well, that was clever enough.
Good to
have you back. Let me let you and Andrew know we have four other folks with questions.
Sure.
We're to that point.
Okay. Andrew, following up on your final point on the chilling effect actually on scientific research, it's my understanding that the basis of some of these claims against Exxon is based upon research that it openly published and was not hiding or dissembling about. Am I correct in that?
Yes, you are. You know, Exxon, like many corporations, sponsors a wide variety of research and things that involve its business interests, and as well as things that are more tangential. And Exxon, in connection with that, had funded a lot of research, some of which was done relatively internally that it published, some of which it didn't publish, some of which was, in some instances, it simply funded research by outside organizations and individuals, and they were free to do with it as they saw fit, as is often the case with the funding of scientific research. The interesting thing is that, when there's been a review of the research that Exxon in particular had funded, as well as the company's own internal review, the company's own internal science regarding climate change, the view has been that it was largely coextensive with the prevailing public views at that point in time regarding the threats and the risks of climate change. And so the idea that Exxon has in its back pocket some secret research that, would have blown the whole thing open meaningfully in any way changed the debate or changed people's minds or anything of that sort seems far-fetched, or at the very least, I certainly haven't seen any indication of that.
Well, and further, to me, it seems that if a company is doing research in an involving field and publishes it, and then finds that published research being used against it, that would almost certainly disincentivize a company from engaging in honest research where the results might not always turn out to, the way they might want it to be. But if they're publishing it, it seems to me it's a chilling effect not only on speech but on science and research.
Well, there certainly is, we know a chilling effect regarding scientific research at this point. A number of scientists have bowed out of participating in climate science because, in their view, the politics of that scientific field have simply become too extreme, and that people holding, in some instances, more moderate views regarding climate change have found themselves being harassed by other climate scientists, being blackballed in terms of being able to publish in leading journals. I mean, in fact, that was one of the issues that arose in the so-called ClimateGate email leaks of several years ago, that a number of the leading climate change scientists were organizing amongst themselves so as to manipulate peer review and to prevent people, other scientists whose views with which they disagreed, from obtaining publication in premier journals. And so for a lot of people, this has already come to bear, even without the threat of criminal penalties, in the field of climate science. And the thought that people who receive funding from one group or another group or come out a certain way on a scientific issue could potentially face a criminal investigation, you can imagine that that could be, for a number of scientists, the straw that breaks the camel's back, and it's just easier to go into some other field.
Right. In an editorial published in the Washington Post, one law professor who is supportive of these investigations sort of flips the charges and claims that people objecting to these investigations are, quote, using a constitutional noose to strangle basic economic regulation. And in that editorial, they go on to say, well, if a pharmacist sells you patent medicine on the basis of his scientific theory that it will cure your cancer, the government is not acting like the Spanish Inquisition when it holds the pharmacist accountable for fraud. How would you distinguish that, if at all?
Well, I mean, I think I would make two points. I mean, the first is that, look, we've all gone to the gas station and filled up our cars. And, I've never gone to the gas station and filled up my car and said, oh, gosh, I recall that these Exxon fuels release a lot of carbon dioxide when you burn them. Therefore, I'm going to go use somebody else's or something like that. The idea that somebody is being defrauded, it has a particular legal meaning. And part of being defrauded involves a lie that induces the victim to give up property. And in this instance, it doesn't really fit the fraud model. Even if you thought that companies like Exxon and all the – even if you thought that everything that a lot of these people in favor of the investigations were saying was true, that doesn't mean that it actually amounts to the legal elements of a fraud claim. Because when you buy gasoline from ExxonMobil, you know what you're getting, and it does more or less what you think it's going to do. If they were selling you something that wasn't gasoline, that would be one thing. Or if it caused your car to explode, that would be another thing as well. But the fact that this entire class of fuels releases carbon dioxide, it may be in a certain sense deceptive, again, if all of these things were true, but it isn't anything that would actually amount to fraud as a legal matter. But I think the second thing is that, you know, it's easy to talk about these things at 10,000 feet and to come up with, you know, silly little hypotheticals like that one, but it's much more difficult to get into the facts and actually identify what exactly is the fraud here? What are the facts supporting it? What has been done? What specifically was withheld? What is the basis to believe that there is some kind of racketeering conspiracy, something like a mafia organization or a drug cartel? What's the basis to believe that that's going on here, sufficient to support a wide-ranging and potentially speech-impairing criminal or civil enforcement investigation? And that's where you really get problems, because a lot of people, you know, have been willing to editorialize that they support this type of investigation, but it's been a lot more difficult, I think, for people to pinpoint exactly why they think there ought to be an investigation, other than that they may disagree with some of the speech and some of the policy positions that have been advocated by these groups.
Well, I think we can open. So Dean said there were calls, so let's open up the floor to other callers.
We do have four callers with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take what is now our first audience question of the day.
Name is Fred Young. I have a question about the anti-SLAPP motion that you made on behalf of CEI in D.C. District Court. Would like to know what the timing of it. It was about a month ago you did it. What do you expect the timing to be? What was your objective, and what do you think the likely outcome is going to be?
Well, first of all, let me repeat my disclaimer that I'm speaking today on my own behalf and not on behalf of my firm or my clients. The motion was filed a while ago now. It's been more than a month ago. I think we argued it about a month ago. And it's currently it's in consideration before the court. And, you know, the expectation is that there'll be a decision in short order. When that could be, it's hard to say, but the statute does provide that courts should decide these types of anti-SLAPP motions at the earliest possible opportunity. For those who don't know, an anti-SLAPP motion is a way of challenging a legal filing that is a SLAPP stands for a strategic lawsuit against public participation. It's when somebody abuses the power of the court to stifle or chill another person's speech. And so in this instance, the Competitive Enterprise Institute filed an anti-SLAPP motion against the U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General as well as his counsel.
What do you think the outcome is going to be, or what was your objective?
Well, our objective in it was simply to vindicate the Competitive Enterprise Institute's First Amendment rights. You know, as the motion explained, the U.S. Virgin Islands investigation, as well as the specific investigatory actions undertaken against the Competitive Enterprise Institute, had no legitimate legal basis whatsoever. And it was our view, or CEI's view, that the U.S. Virgin Islands would not be able to demonstrate that they had a legitimate legal basis. And I think the briefing on that motion has borne that out. And so we have every hope and expectation that the court will recognize as much, and in so doing, will vindicate CEI's First Amendment rights that you know, an attorney general can't abuse his investigatory powers to target a group like CEI for its speech activities.
You'd be looking for legal fees and also punitive damages?
I think in those respects, the motion speaks for itself.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Four questions yet to get to. Let's take another call.
Hello, Bendler. How is the U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General Claude Earlwalker justifying the claim that he has jurisdiction over ExxonMobil?
Well, you know, it's a wonderful question, and I think it's something that's been a mystery to a lot of people involved in this. As a little bit of background, if a state is going to take legal action against somebody, typically it has to be somebody who, you know, has something to do with that state. They might be there in that state. They might, you know, have subjected itself to that state's jurisdiction. But generally speaking, the U.S. Virgin Islands couldn't, you know, as a random hypothetical, just reach out to somebody in Idaho and attempt to slap them with charges or demand that they do something or other. In this instance, the U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General, as I understand it, has put forward two theories of jurisdiction. ExxonMobil, I should say, has no assets over there and doesn't conduct any business over there, to my understanding. CEI certainly doesn't. And the U.S. Virgin Islands Attorney General's claim has been that I think its pension fund may have invested in some ExxonMobil stock, which, frankly, it's baffling to me how that would have anything to do with jurisdiction, and that perhaps maybe it's advertising or something like that it reached out to the island, which, you know, maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. I don't know, but I certainly haven't seen any evidence of that. I would note that the Competitive Enterprise Institute did, in fact, make that point in its legal argumentation before a D.C. court, and the counsel for the U.S. Virgin Islands simply claimed that they didn't even need jurisdiction to go after people who have nothing to do with the U.S. Virgin Islands, and that their regulatory authority allows them to reach, it appeared as if they were saying, anybody in the entire country. So perhaps if you are some person in Idaho or California or where have you, and you've never been to the U.S. Virgin Islands, you still might want to watch out, because in their view, they could target you with subpoenas and investigations and so on. Even perhaps for people who've never heard of the place.
Thank you.
Looks like we have three questions remaining, so let's take another call.
Hi, I know you're not a scientist, and I'm not going to ask you to do that, but I'm wondering if you could provide some ethical advice on or political advice or news advice as to whether the 29 attorneys general on the other side are taking a position that, look, we're not going to do this, or are any of those others thinking about, okay, well, you know, what's your skin in the game if there is a binary us versus them kind of politics in the country? And, I mean, is anyone thinking about doing similar things in reverse?
Well,
and
I mean,
would that be wrong?
I mean, first of all, you know, obviously I'm not going to provide any legal or ethical advice.
No, I meant philosophical.
But I'm certainly happy to comment on the issue. And, you know, as I see it and as I read the letter that was signed by the other attorneys general, the ones who are not members of the AGs United for Clean Power or for Clean Energy Coalition, what I thought they were doing was recognizing that you know, it raises very serious issues when an attorney general from one state reaches into another state and to affect the residents of that state. All these attorneys general swear oaths to uphold the Constitution as well as to protect their own citizens from violations of the law. That's what they do. That's what they dedicate their careers to. And to my mind, it's not something that happens a lot, but it certainly raises very serious concerns that implicate that oath when an attorney general from another state says, I'm going to go after people because of their speech, because of their advocacy. I'm going to target them, and I'm going to do that even if they're in other states. And in this instance, you had an attorney general from the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as a coalition of them from a potpourri of other states, saying that they were going to go after a Texas organization, that is ExxonMobil, and that they were going to go after a number of think tanks and other public policy organizations, perhaps other energy companies, scattered throughout the country, including in states where they have attorney generals who have looked at this and believe that this investigation is really aimed at chilling speech and, you know, it represents a violation of their constituents' First Amendment rights, their civil rights. And so it seems to me perfectly appropriate for a state attorney general to stand up and say, I'm going to protect my citizens' civil rights. Would that more of them did that in appropriate circumstances?
Great. Thanks.
We're down to two calls right now, callers with questions. If you'd like to join the queue, I think we'll have time for a third question. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's head in the direction of our next caller now. Go ahead, caller. If you have yourself on mute, you need to unmute your telephone.
It's probably me, Peggy, again.
You've rung in again, Peggy.
Okay. Well, I just want to have access because I had to switch phones. And I do have a follow-up on that last question. It's just it's an informational piece. The caller had talked about doing something in reverse. And there's a very interesting piece published by Professor Coffey at Columbia Law School in the Columbia Law School Blue Sky blog. And his piece focuses on the New York Attorney General's Martin Act investigation. But he does make, I think, the very compelling point that the last caller alluded to, that not only is investigations, do they require us to judge history at midstream before the public debate has played out? But it also uniquely penalizes one side. He points out that if the corporation has to explain its donations, its records, its research, and to explain what its advocates and organizations have done, whereas the activist side is not in that same position of having to explain where it gets its donations, how it formulates its theories. So there's an asymmetry, and I thought that was an excellent point he made and that the prior caller had alluded to as well. That's it for me.
Any reaction, Andrew Grossman?
No, it's a very interesting point.
Okay. We've still got two questions pending. Let's take another call.
Hi, my name is Mike Easter. I am a scientist and a member of the Federalist Society. And I'm just curious as to how far these subpoenas go down. I supply information to a large number of industries on toxicological-related research, and I'm just concerned as a consultant providing that information if I would be possibly pulled into this type of thing. And then the second question is, you mentioned that they're looking at going after, I believe you mentioned, vaccine manufacturers. Given the focus on fracking as a means by which to find petroleum reserves, has there been any interest or any indication that they would use a similar type of tactic for reviewing fracking? And those are my two questions.
Sure. I mean, in terms of how the subpoenas go, you know, perhaps in contrast with what may have been a gloomy mood for a lot of the remarks on this call, I can say that so far the subpoena effort has been a disaster. The U.S. Virgin Islands subpoenaed ExxonMobil. The island's attorney general dropped it after ExxonMobil sued them for civil rights violations, and as settlement for that suit, they simply abandoned it. They withdrew the one from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. First, the one that they had reissued by D.C. courts, and then second, the one that Attorney General Claude Walker had issued himself. So they appear to be backpedaling quite furiously, and even Attorney General Schneiderman seems to have realized that what has happened so far was by and large an embarrassment and a disaster. And so in terms of your question, how far is this going to go? We don't know. At this point, I think they've seen that, at least I hope that they've seen and come to realize that they simply can't undertake these actions with impunity. You can't, use your law enforcement authority to target people for their protected speech and protected petitioning activities, with the expectation that that it'll go forward like any other law enforcement investigation, because of course it isn't any other law enforcement investigation. And in that sense, we're kind of at a fork in the road. It's possible that they will redouble their efforts, and that we'll see a flurry more of investigations, and that this will become somewhat of a juggernaut. At least until it's grinds to a halt in the litigation. And the other possibility is that they'll just slink away quietly, and that will be the end of this effort. And right now, we don't really know which way it's going to go. In terms of these tactics moving over into the fracking domain, we've already seen – I don't think we've seen these type of law enforcement-type investigations yet in that area, but we've certainly seen a wide variety of creative use of the law to uncover, proprietary fracking techniques and fluids and that kind of thing. We know there's been litigation in a number of states to force regulators to divulge material information and mixtures and other confidential and proprietary information regarding fracking techniques. And that's largely been done by environmentalist groups, who seek to perhaps in some instances cause somewhat of a competitive disadvantage for people in that field. Due to their opposition to that technique. So, you know, is it likely that we would see the expansion of these types of law enforcement activities to target fracking? I think at this point it would probably be premature to say that the answer is yes, but if this succeeds in the area of climate change and climate policy, my fear is that we're going to see these types of tactics used across the board. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that would be a natural area to apply them.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm very, very troubled by this approach. You'd mentioned the problems that it creates with respect to science in general, but I see the issue at the university, you know, point where we're not going to allow dialogue on controversial topics, and that really diminishes the ability to develop critical thinking, and that really, I think, is deleterious to good public policy. But that's just my opinion. Anyways, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I think we have time for a final question.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS. And I'm curious as to why these attorney generals took that approach, which I think is totally wrong, as opposed to the fact that under divided sovereignty, states have sovereignty over internal improvements. And so all their activities, everything having to do with roads and the effect of energy applied to roads, seems to fall under their jurisdiction anyway. And if they want to address climate change, they could address it individually. And or the president, if he wanted to apply climate change procedures, could do it under his commander-in-chief duty to defend liberty for posterity.
Well, I mean, in a general sense, you know, it was very puzzling when they announced the AGs United for Clean Energy, because when you hear the name, you know, the anticipation is that they're going to do something like advocating in favor of, you know, particular types of energy sources, you know, maybe subsidies or changing regulations or this or that. And so it is kind of an unusual thing. But this is something that I think that we've seen more and more in recent years. We've seen, of course, the criminalization of politics. We've seen, you know, regulatory criminalization across the field. And at this point, we're seeing increasingly the criminalization of dissent, that somebody holding a contrary view is not merely wrong or misguided or in a more generous of spirit time. Maybe they have a point and maybe you should hash it out. But it's this ability or inability, rather, to respectfully disagree, and this view that if somebody holds a contrary opinion or position, and they advocate in favor of that they're involved in some kind of criminal conduct, and that could be the only possible explanation. And it's a very strange thing, because anybody who knows you know, the people, particularly at these groups that are being alleged to be mouthpieces for ExxonMobil or something of that sort, knows that, you know, at a lot of these think tanks and free market advocacy groups, you have people who are very ideologically committed, who are very philosophically thoughtful people, and in many instances, people who forewent potentially lucrative careers in business so as to advocate in favor of those particular principles. And the idea that you know, they're engaged in some kind of conspiracy or something of that sort is nonsense, because that's not why they're there, and it's not what they do. But, you know, the idea that, you know, the thought that there are other things, you know, that somebody with, you know, an agenda that favored certain types of power sources could do other than launching criminal investigations, yeah, there are a million different things you could imagine. But the foremost one in a general sense would be participating in the political process rather than abusing law enforcement powers. But I suppose they still have the power and the ability to reconsider that.
Thanks.
Well, let me just add that I think that's what Andrew is working to determine. they may or may not have that power.
Well, Peggy Little, Andrew Grossman, it appears that we are out of time and out of questions. Maybe we have 60 seconds or so left. Peggy, do you want to ask a final question or give Andrew a chance to express a final thought here?
I think one other factor to keep in mind is that the tobacco template keeps being raised, and that involved the transfer of a great deal of wealth, not only to the contingency fee lawyers, which Andrew correctly pointed out is an important aspect of what's going on here, but also to the states. And I took a look at the 19 or 20 states that are in the AG's United, and with the exception of Virginia, every single one of those states is in fiscal, some of them are in grave fiscal trouble, but all of them fall in the bottom 50 of states in poor fiscal health. And so I think a certain amount of, because they are citing the tobacco litigation as a model, and that did involve the transfer of over a quarter of a trillion dollars, or almost a quarter of a trillion dollars to the states, perhaps a little realism in what the ultimate goal here is would be in order.
Final thought from Andrew Grossman?
I feel like I've already said so much, but I would certainly thank everybody for participating and listening and for all the wonderful questions.
Well, my thanks as well to Peggy Little and to Andrew Grossman and to the audience for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to check your emails and check in with the Federal Society's website for an announcement about our next scheduled Teleform conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.